Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I would rather be in my dysfunctional and completely effed up state of Alabama on so many levels than be in completely effed up and dysfunctional New York. And I realized that, you know, I'm not the kind of person that just sits idly and watches the world go by. So if I'm going to be active, why not be active somewhere that I love?
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Kaya Stevens went from her tiny hometown in Alabama to Sarah Lawrence College in New York for grad school. For a lot of people, it might have been a springboard to a bigger world. But Stevens ended up going back home and making her own world bigger. Back in 2002, she started teaching poetry to inmates at a state prison. And from that small start, she's built the Alabama Prison Arts and Education Project. More than 175 faculty members have provided education to more than 5,000 prisoners across the state. Her guiding principle is simple. No human being should be thrown away. Here's our conversation. Kaya Stevens, I normally don't really start out by asking people about their hometown, but it seems like that's a big part of your story. So tell us about Waverly, Alabama.
Okay, well, historical context would be my grandparents bought about 100 acres in Waverly in the mid-50s. And my grandfather was an organic chemistry professor here at Auburn and loved fishing. And this location had a beautiful pond. It's an old grist mill. And so that's where my brother and I spent most of our time growing up. And it was magical because our parents were working. And so we were just kind of left to our own devices, which meant putzing around in the woods and going fishing and canoeing and just being outside. And I think being present with the land, even as a young clueless kid, was pretty important. I probably didn't realize how important it was till I got a little bit older.
And what was your kind of family like? Had your family been there for a long time?
So, my mom's family has been in this area for many, many, many generations. And then my dad's family moved here when my grandfather came to be a chemistry professor. I think they moved in the late 40s. So yeah, we've been around for a while. Our family's been connected to Auburn University for a very long time. So of course, when I was growing up, I was going to leave the Auburn and Waverly area and never come back. And of course, here I sit.
Look what happened. Yeah. And how big is Waverly?
I think at the last census, it's 164 people.
So do you literally know everybody in town?
I know most everybody. I'm a little bit of a homebody, so I don't really go out and mingle about. But I know who people are. I recognize them. I don't necessarily have a social interaction with them, though.
And when did poetry come into your life? How did that? Oh, how gosh. Did you find that?
So my mom's mom, she did research here at Auburn for a long time, and my brother and I would come down when we lived in North Alabama for a little while. We would come down and spend a week with her, and she had all of her father's poetry books on this bookcase, and I remember being 8 or 9 years old or something like that, and again, clueless. You're pretty clueless at that age, but I remember sitting there reading poems and loving them. And then I didn't really come back to writing poetry until I was in high school. I never studied it as an undergraduate. I'm definitely from that family mindset of you have to go and study and get a degree that's going to help you get a job. And so I spent a lot of time trying to find all those things that was going to help me get a job. And then I just decided that I actually really liked being an English major. And the English major helped me get my job.
So when you were growing up before all that happened, what did you think you were going to be?
Oh, gosh. I think my imagination pushed me all over the place. For a really long time, I wanted to move out west and be a park ranger. And there are some days that I still imagine doing that. Although these days, my dream would be to move to New Zealand and do that.
Oh, yeah. And so you went to Auburn, right, as an undergrad, as many in your family had done.
Yes.
But then you ended up going to Sarah Lawrence for grad school.
Yes.
And based on everything you've said up to this moment, Sarah Lawrence sounds like an awfully strange place to be going.
Yes.
So how did that happen, and what was it like?
So I was actually working in Atlanta. I was doing digital photography and writing for a graphic design company. And I don't exactly remember the day or the circumstance where I realized that I truly was a nerd and that I really just wanted to be back in an academic setting where people are constantly challenging each other with ideas. So I walked down to the library because back then we didn't really have internet researching capabilities. And I read two little paragraphs about the women's history program at Sarah Lawrence. And I said, oh, that's where I want to go. So that's the only place I applied to, which is not the advice that you should ever give anyone.
Yeah, that's not guidance counselor advice, right?
No. But... And it was wonderful. I mean, it was a huge change for me. I grew up in rural Alabama, and I showed up in Yonkers, New York with my truck and my dog. And I was like, yes, you are the stereotype. and I had some adjustment period, but it was fantastic. I loved being there. I loved being around people who... just spend their whole time and being and pushing really hard to figure out answers to really difficult questions. I had an amazing peers. So I went there to do the women's history program, and in very short order, Tom Lux, who, bless him, he's not here anymore, he invited me to join the MFA program as well. So I did both of them and I had a wonderful time. And then I needed to leave.
I've always wondered about, you know, being a Southerner in a situation like that, especially when, as you say, you've got the accent, the dog in the truck and that sort of thing. Did people there see you as some sort of exotic creature? You know, was it like, did people come up and ask you sort of how you lived and what you ate the way they might ask, you know, a Martian who had just landed on Earth?
Well, some people did, and then they realized that I was a really good cook, and they would just be quiet. But you know, in some ways, that was such a useful experience for me in just furthering the process and thinking about how we as a society just traditionally other all kinds of groups of people and how we just constantly, we make people feel small. And I don't actually find that very useful. And it goes in every single direction. People in the North pick on folks in the South. People in the South pick on folks in the North. And, you know, there's always, you know, they're saying, oh, I'm just, you know, this is just good fun. But I believe at the root of all, quote unquote, good fun is a sincere resentment or diminishment or I'm scared of you, you make me uncomfortable. And that was very motivating for me in my historical research and in my writing when I was up there, but also when I came back home, because I realized I would rather be in my dysfunctional and completely effed up state of Alabama on so many levels than be in completely effed up and dysfunctional New York. And I realized that, you know, I'm not the kind of person that just sits idly and watches the world go by. So if I'm going to be active, why not be active somewhere that I love?
And my understanding is that you were the last poet in Alabama they reached out to, that everybody else basically turned this job down.
Oh, yeah, no, people didn't want to do it.
And so what made you want to do it?
Because there wasn't a good reason not to do it. I mean, if you love poetry and you love teaching and there is an opportunity to go teach something that you love, really it kind of makes you an asshole to turn down that opportunity because you feel uncomfortable by a group of people. But again, I have never been the kind of person that looks at someone who is incarcerated or someone who is poor or someone who is X, Y, and Z in a way that they are somehow less than me. They're in a circumstance that's different than me, but their life is not less than mine.
So could you sort of describe what it was like at the very beginning when you started that program? Now, obviously, it's well established. You know, it's known statewide, but at the beginning, it was just you, right?
Yes.
And you had never done this type of thing before. So what was it like walking in there the first time?
Well, you know, I had to go to the prison several times for clearance-related issues before I actually started teaching. The first day that I went to teach, I really had no training. I got some training from the prison. That, you know, just said all this really offensive language about the people on the inside and what, you know, you should and should not do. But it's also very much the language of the machine of corrections. So I've got all that rolling around in my head, and I walk into class the first time and I'm just like, oh, it's a bunch of guys who want to talk about poetry, and this is not at all what I expected. Because society creates such a view of who is in prison and why they are there, and that they must somehow be a horrible human being because they are incarcerated. And that's not accurate. People make horrible decisions. And some people have a lifetime of making horrible decisions. But I think if you dig hard enough, you can find out all the connective tissue for why somebody is making really bad decisions. And I don't necessarily think that makes the core of the person a bad person. So I had these really amazing students that I worked with there for about a year and a half. And I don't know, within a month or so, I was just like, yeah, I'm going to keep doing this. And I just have to figure out how.
I want to loop back. You talked about corrections and the training you got and that sort of thing. Were the corrections people and like the wardens, the guards, whoever you might have seen and dealt with on a daily basis, were they bought into all this stuff, or was there resistance there?
Oh, there were people all over the spectrum. And just a language thing, officers actually like to be called officers. And because I don't like people to use degrading language toward me, I'm just going to call them officers. How's that? So there were officers who thought I was from Mars and had no understanding about why we were doing poetry classes on the inside. And then there were officers who were gracious and lovely and wanted to know what we were doing and very supportive. So it's all over the spectrum.
I know if I have this right, correct me if I'm wrong, that when you go into one of these situations, you don't ask, like, what are you in for, basically, or anything like that,
nope.
Right?
I have no interest in knowing that. And but, we train our teachers not to ask that.
But in the writing and in their talking about, I'm sure, you know, poetry is accessing your deepest feelings, emotions, things that may have happened to you, things you may have done. Have you ended up learning a lot of that stuff along the way?
I have learned some of that. But, you know, incarceration doesn't define the human existence of these people. And so when you're writing poetry and you're giving them assignments, we structure our program to give people assignments that they can step into in any way they want to. And the equivalent that I can use for something like this is that if a straight person walked into a group of LGBTQ youth and said, your assignment today is to write about what it feels like to be a queer kid in Alabama, I would hope that somebody in that kid would just, or in that room, would get up and walk out, because that is a voyeuristic request on the part of the person who's teaching. So we don't go in and ask people to write about their incarceration. I think that is disgusting, actually. We empower them to write about what they want to write about, which is what all serious creative writing and academic classes do.
I guess maybe let me ask this a different way then.
Okay.
Because I guess my impression or my expectation if I was walking in to teach one of these classes, is that that would be what they would write about.
Nope.
And so what other types of things, I mean, describe some of the stuff you've read over the years.
They write about their family. They write about their mom. They write about fishing. They write about a lot of hopes for the future and what they want to do with their life. And a lot of people, most people who are incarcerated are parents, and they miss their children intensely, and they want to a different life, and so that shows up in their creative writing a lot. And there are also a lot of very intense social critiques on systems that we have built in our country that perpetuate poverty and racism and just the vast othering that we do. But they very seldom just say, okay, I'm going to write about what it means to be incarcerated.
When we come back, Kaya Stevens talks about what she's learned from prisoners on the inside and what happens when she sees them on the outside. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I'm Mike Collins. Join me for a special WFAE public conversation exploring Charlotte's rising homicide count and community-based solutions for addressing public safety. That's Tuesday evening, July 30th at 7:30 at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. Details at WFAE.org.
If you'd like to be a part of the Southbound community, we'd love to hear from you. You can suggest ideas for future guests at our homepage, which is WFAE.org/Southbound. You can also reach me directly by email at etomlinson@wfae.org or tweet at me at Tommy Tomlinson. And it will really help if you subscribe to the NPR One app and listen to Southbound there. That lets NPR know directly that you're out there listening. Thanks for all your support. Now, back to our conversation with Kaya Stevens. I also wondered, thinking about resistance or pushback or whatever, I suspect that many the people who've been in for a while especially have seen lots of people come in and try to do good, you know, and maybe they stayed for a week or two and they couldn't take it, or they, you know, they washed out or whatever and they were gone again. And I wonder if there was any skepticism about you from them when you walked in the door.
Sure. I'm just another privileged white woman from Alabama coming in to save somebody's soul. And that's what they think. That's what they see. And you're right. People come in and they do something for a short amount of time and they pat themselves on the back and tell themselves what a great human being they are, and then they leave. But when you look at, when you look at the broadest and best impacts of art and education, you want high quality and sustained interactions. So if you are looking and working with a group of people who have pretty much, I know this is a generalization, but pretty much had horrible access to meaningful education K through 12, you can't come in and do a 3-week program. If you're trying to help people build a different life and see themselves in a different way inside of the world, education and learning has to become a way of being. Because that is then how you create cultural and systemic change, right? You have to, it's the long-term investment. And the long-term investment is expensive and it is not easy. And everybody wants a silver bullet that's going to work in 6 months. And that doesn't work with any group of human beings.
Was there a moment for you when you felt like, oh, this is going to work and I could do something really meaningful here?
Yeah, well, I mean, it really, within a couple of months of being inside, I realized that there was something that really could happen here.
Was it like a more gradual kind of dawning, or did something happen where that's sort of that kind of flash moment?
I just saw people writing amazing poems, and they had never had the chance to do so. And when you have, you know, people, human beings are so curious and so creative You know, somebody who builds a house is an intensely creative person. It doesn't show up in the same way as somebody creating a painting, but it's still creativity. And if you don't have an outlet for creativity, I think it kind of crushes human beings. So when you go into prisons, and you, and particularly in Alabama, and you see a sea of human beings suffering and profoundly suffering, and you know that there are things that can help a person dig themselves out of that, that becomes a part of their process of becoming the self that they want to be. And the poem can help somebody do that.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask. Are there a couple of people that when you think about the impact that y'all have had that you think of right away?
Yeah, there are. And when the shizzle gets really deep, and that happens with this program, and often I focus on them.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had about 5,000 people go through our programming on the inside, and I have known some of our students since, you know, some of them since 2003, 2004, and they're still there. And so that's what we focus on, right, is human beings working and building. And the individuals who come to our classes become the most powerful advocates to their peers inside of the facility, to get involved and to try. And maybe they don't want to come to an Auburn University class, but maybe they get motivated to go get their GED. And that is fantastic, right? It doesn't, you want people engaging with education in all levels. And if they're not ready to do GED, go to the Adult Basic Education Program or learn how to read and write your name.
You talked about when the shizzle hits the fan occasionally. So what does that mean? Is that like talking about funding, or is that people?
Funding is always a struggle. It has been a struggle since day one. This is not an easy program to support in the Deep South. Because we are a tough on crime mentality, and it's frustrating. I understand accountability, and I think accountability is 100% appropriate. I have a hard time throwing human beings away.
It seems like you're having to navigate two very complicated structures there, right? You know, the large university and a state legislature or a state bureaucracy as well.
That might be the understatement of the century. But that's what everything is, right? If you're trying, you have to negotiate all kinds of communities and perspectives and strategic plans and values and missions in most anything that you do.
It feels to me that part of your personality is to dive right into the complicated stuff. That, you know, you obviously see the prisoners' lives as something more than whatever they're in there for. I wonder if that comes from your own upbringing, the things you had to navigate as a young person. Am I on the right track here at all?
Yeah, of course. But even, you know, even when I was a small kid and I had no clue that I was queer, right? I didn't even know what that meant. I have always had a very keen sense of what is right and wrong and how human beings are treated.
Is there a story your family tells about that?
No, there was an interaction when I was really young. I love animals. Right now there are 15 cats, 3 dogs, and like 30 chickens. Like, I love animals. Oh, and there's a bunny. Somebody dumped a bunny at the house. So I was probably like 5 years old, and I just have always felt so incredibly close and bonded to animals. And so there was a lot of PBS. You know, we lived in the woods and there was not cable. And I wanted to watch this National Geographic special on seals. And my mom was just like, she knew what it was. I didn't know. And she said, no, I really don't think you should do that. And I was a pretty demanding 5-year old. Maybe I'm just a pretty demanding person. But anyway, you know, I pitched a fit and she let me watch it. And of course it was about the fur trade. And it showed all these images of baby seals getting clubbed to death. And when you're me as a 5-year-old and you're already a pretty sensitive heart, it made a super powerful impression on me. And then when I was in high school, I started an Amnesty International at my school. That was a pretty influential, I think, just in terms of thinking about systems of putting people away. And human injustice.
Do you name the chickens?
Some. They're, Rhoda is the beloved right now. She is a little bantam cochin who unfortunately was attacked by a fox earlier, late in the spring, but she's now the $700 hen, but she's doing great.
Have any, you know, you mentioned one of your, the guys you worked with in prison who had been paroled out and all. Have folks who have, you know, gotten out of the system and, you know, worked with you and wrote with you and all, have they looked you up on the outside? And
some do. We do not push our students to do that. They are welcome to, and they know that.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time when people leave prison, they don't want to ever think about it again. And even if they had a wonderful experience with us, thinking about our program makes them think about being incarcerated. And I want to leave it up to somebody else to make the decision as to whether or not they want to do that.
Have you ever been like walking around on campus or in Montgomery or somewhere on the street and see somebody across the way that you recognize?
Yeah, sure have.
So how do you feel when that happens?
Completely overwhelmed because the one incident that I'm thinking about, somebody who I consider a good friend at this point, we reconnected several years ago in Birmingham, and I'm not really a crier at all. Like, I mean, okay, so I'll cry at like Pixar movies, but I'm not really a crier. And she came up and tapped me on my shoulder, and I turned around and I looked at her, and we just both burst into tears. Because to be able to see somebody who you built an educational relationship with on the inside and to see them outside thriving is an incredible feeling.
So I want to kind of ask this in two parts. Let me ask kind of the narrow version first. How has doing this job informed your poetry?
That's a good question. So my honest answer is these days I don't get much of a chance to write poetry anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I work I work too many hours. And I understand.
You're a victim of your own success.
Well, yes. But I also, there is a very intense weight that comes with doing this work. And when I sit down to work on a writing project, this is not exactly what I want to think about at this moment. It's not saying that I won't do it later, because I will. But it is, you know, it's a trauma. It's traumatic. When you talk with people who, I spent, you know, on and off about 10 years working with a volunteer fire department, and when you see, you know, human suffering and tragedy and trauma all the time, it impacts you. And then with this work, seeing the type of trauma and the battle that it is to exist as a program, is tiresome. It doesn't mean we're stopping. It just means it's tiresome. And when I sit down to take a brain break, thinking about prison and incarceration is not the first place that I want to go.
So here's the bigger question. Okay. What is this work you've done in prison, what has it taught you in a larger sense?
Gosh. There are so many things. I think all these years of working with our folks on the inside and people who have just lived through such horrific human experiences that obviously impacted their decision-making to be in prison, I think I've met some of the most beautiful people in my life on the inside of a prison, and it makes me wonder why they're there. Why are we so, what is it about our society that makes us so hell-bent punishing and putting people away and not lifting each other up? Being in prison has made me an infinitely more kind person and patient. I'm super opinionated. I always have been, and I, probably to a flaw, am too willing to tell people my opinions on things. But I think being in prison all these years and working with our students has also really taught me being silent is not helpful. And if you see something that and it needs to be said, say it, and you are going to make some people uncomfortable. But if you don't say it, then how does change happen?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because the next question I was going to ask is about living in Alabama in 2019. You know, with the, obviously the legislature has made some decisions that are very painful to progressive folks in Alabama. And I guess I just wonder, as many of us wonder who live in the South, how do you reconcile living in a place that makes those kind of decisions and it being a place that you still love?
Well, as being from a group of people who has had decisions made about their life and what they can do with their life for a very long time, for me, it makes me like cinch down my belt and be like, okay, makes me want to fight harder. And it's also, I think that it's worth noting that all these politicians and all these rules and all these laws and all these things that are happening, that does not represent all of Alabama. It does absolutely represent some of Alabama. But, you know, people too quickly want to make blanket statements about the Deep South and the people therein. And I moved back here for a reason. I mean, there are beautiful people here working super hard, trying to be agents of change. People who are making remarkable art, some of the wackiest, quirkiest, just most lovely humans here in the grand state of Alabama. And it doesn't hurt my feelings when other people at this point want to trash the state, because everybody is always looking for something to trash so that they can divert attention from themselves or their own state and the decisions that are happening in their own state. We happen to be an easy target right now.
So I want to wrap up here. You know, I think you've alluded to this along the way, but not only did you move back to Alabama, but you moved back to Waverly, right?
I sure did.
Now, are you on is this the old family place or is this somewhere different?
No, I moved to the other side of town. So okay. That I could have a little bit of distance.
So do you still have family there?
I do. My mom and dad live on the land where I grew up, and I see them on a regular basis, and it is great to see them. I am very anti-development and growth. Like, I don't really feel the need to just cut down all the beautiful trees and build a house. So there was a beautiful old farmhouse for sale on the other side of town, so I bought that.
So the big question I wanted to ask about that is this. So you grew up there, obviously. You've had all these incredible experiences, and now you live there again. So how do you see that place where you grew up now through the lens of the person that you've become?
That's a very complicated question.
We got time.
You know, when I was growing up in Waverly and in Alabama, I was aware on a kid level understanding of racism. I understood discrimination. I did not understand the scope to which it is just embedded in everything that we do, And so I think this kind of, I'm going to say this, and I think maybe it sums up how I feel about my town. When you ask the white citizens of Waverly, Alabama, about how many churches there are in town, they say that there are two. There are not two. There are two white churches, right? They don't include the congregations of the black population. And that to me is perfectly indicative of who we are as a town.
I would also say it says a little something about the South that a town of 150 people would have at least three churches.
Right, and if you want to count the community of Waverly, then the number of churches gets much larger. If you just count the city limits, there are just three.
Guy Stevens, thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you, and I really appreciate your efforts to kind of help people understand why people love the South, and why people choose to move back there. I wouldn't live anywhere else in the U.S., I don't think. It's a great place to call home.
The hell with Thomas Wolfe. You can go back home again. And home, for Southerners like Kaya Stevens, is exactly where they need to be. I've heard the same things, maybe you have too, from friends and colleagues who don't live down here and wonder how we can put up with the forces that always want to drag us backwards, back into a time when America was great for rich white men, but not so much for others. For me, anyway, the answer is twofold. One is that the love I have for this place outweighs the hateful people who make up part of it. And the other is that I grew up on the coast, and I know about tides. They're not always going out. The cool water comes in to refresh and nourish us. It might not run as deep as we want or last as long, but it always comes. And when it does, it changes us for the better. So those of us who choose to stay, go about our work and wait for the next tide to come in. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where we have show notes for each episode with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.